This is Voices from Appalachia Radio Show, sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. I'm Brian Staggers, and here's your host, Bianca Eisen.
This year marks the centennial anniversary of the West Virginia Mine Wars and Trials, when 24 coal miners were tried for treason in Charlestown after the Battle of Blair Mountain in the spring of 1922. Here to talk with me more about the Mine Wars and Trials is Denise Jardina. Denise is a two-time recipient of the Weatherford Award for significant Appalachian work for her novels Storming Heaven and Unquiet Earth. She has also received the Chaffin Award for Appalachian Writing, among other accolades, and was chosen for the 2002 Appalachian Heritage Writer-in-Residence here at Shepherd University by the Shepherd Foundation and West Virginia Humanities Council. Denise, thank you for joining me.
Glad to be here.
So to begin with, Denise, as an author, you've chosen to write extensively around the subject of the West Virginia Mine Wars. What drew you to write about this topic?
Well, I grew up in a coal camp. And coal mining parts of West Virginia are the parts that I grew up in and familiar with. And yet I never heard about the Mine Wars until I was out of college, or in college. And so I couldn't believe that it wasn't known about. And in fact, as I asked around, nobody seemed to know anything about it. And that was back before, about the time my book came out, the movie Mate One came out with John Sayles' movie. And there was a West Virginia Public TV did a documentary called Even the Heavens Weep. So all of a sudden, all those things about the Mine Wars came out. But when I started writing the book, it had not been... Nobody was writing about it or talking about it, and I'd never heard of it. So I was kind of shocked when I did hear about it, and I just thought this story needs to be told.
Was there a specific point during this time that you're most interested in?
Not really. It's the whole thing, I think. I am interested in something that doesn't get talked about very much, which is that this whole thing started not just with coal, but with coal companies and timber companies coming and land companies coming in and basically buying the land, so that most of Southern West Virginia is absentee owned. And I don't think people talk about that enough, because when we look at the problems we have in West Virginia, whether it's poverty, education, it goes back to the fact that we have almost no tax base because the land is owned by absentee companies, who pay very little in taxes. And so we don't have a tax base to build schools, for example. And it also strangles any kind of enterprise, which I try to say this to people who are conservative capitalists, and say to them, look, how would you be a conservative capitalist in Magdale County when there's no land to put a business on? It doesn't matter if you're the best entrepreneur in the world, if there's no land to put a business on. And I'm not talking about because of the geography. I'm talking about because companies like Georgia Pacific, which is owned by the Koch brothers, and Norfolk and Southern Railroad, they own the whole county, just about 87% of the county. And so where do you find land to, also, where do you find land to even build a house on? That's one reason so many people live in trailers in the southern part of the state, because if a company decides to make you leave, it's easier to pick up a trailer than it is to pick up a house. There's not very much new housing. And so all that stuff, you can't have a functioning capitalist economy and have that kind of absentee land ownership. It's just not possible.
With regards to the land ownership, that was essentially how these companies got the land to begin was with through these broad form deeds, forging people's signatures. So are there any efforts today to get this land back from companies that still own it?
No, not. The only thing that's happened in my lifetime is that in Eastern Kentucky, there was a movement to stop companies from mining on land where there was a surface owner. And the situation there was that, an individual owned the surface land that he lived on, but the company owned the minerals underneath. And so they would just say, well, we want our minerals, so we can tear up your land and get our minerals. And that was stopped in Kentucky. But the situation in West Virginia is different because the landowner doesn't own his land either. He doesn't own the surface or the minerals. The company owns both. And so there was never any recourse really. And nobody, I think there was an effort in the 80s to try to get taxes raised that maybe that would encourage these companies to sell. But that didn't really go very far. And so, no, nothing's happened. They still own the land and they still aren't paying taxes. And there's no, there's certainly not any interest in the legislature or in the governor's office to do anything about it. So nothing's happened.
Do you have any thoughts as to why the story wasn't being told sooner?
Well, I think several things. One is that the people who actually participated were afraid to talk about it because, as you know, we just had the 100th anniversary of the treason trials in Charlestown, which is still going on. And you know, people have been tried for treason, which is not a light thing. And people were afraid to talk about it. They were also, even without the treason charges, were afraid of losing their jobs. You know, if you were if a coal company found out that you had been part of the mine wars, they would fire you, kick you out of your house. So there was all that. And then on top of that, certainly the coal industry had no intention of allowing that to be taught in public schools. And so there was no, you know, the people who wrote the West Virginia history books back in the day did not include the mine wars. And I even took a West Virginia history class at West Virginia Wesleyan, where I went to college, and it was not mentioned. I didn't learn about it until I came across a book in a bookstore in Charleston. That's when I first learned about it. So I think it's a combination of fear and repression.
So you've written Storming Heaven, which focuses around leading up to Blair Mountain. There's also been the movie Medwan, as you've said, and other documentaries. Do you feel like it's becoming more and more well-known, the events that led up to the mine wars?
I think it certainly is better known today than it was in 1980 when I started writing the book. But it's still not talked about in schools very much. It depends on the teacher. It depends on the school. There's certainly plenty of people who graduate from high school in West Virginia and take West Virginia history classes who probably still have never heard of it. But then other schools, they have. If there's a teacher that's interested in it and knows about it and wants to teach it and thinks it's important, then it'll be taught. But certainly, I think the 80s were a really important time to finally start bringing this to the public's attention. And even a couple of years ago, the American Experience on PBS had an hour-long show about the mine wars. So there's definitely much more opportunity now to learn about it. And I think the 80s, as I mentioned, the books and the films that came out in the 80s, really, the 80s were an interesting time in terms of not just Appalachian history, but many cultural groups were reclaiming their history. That's when the TV show Roots came out, when African-American history, there was a focus on African-American history. Native Americans and other, I think, ethnic minorities began to look at their own history and say, we've got a heritage to be proud of here. And that included Appalachian people. And so you saw a renewed interest then in the mine wars and other subjects like that.
On the topic, Denise, of the role of ethnic minorities, how did they play a part in the mine wars? Because even in Storming Heaven, you have Dr. Booker, who was the doctor for the strikers, and you also have Johnson, who was a union organizer who came down to help, who unfortunately met his demise at the hands of company thugs.
Yeah, there was a strong African-American presence, first of all, among miners themselves. Coal mining drew a lot of workers from a lot of places, including the South, and a lot of African-Americans came to West Virginia and Kentucky also to work in the mines because they could escape Jim Crow that way. If you were a miner in Alabama, and I've actually done some oral histories with a mining family from Alabama who said when they came, this was an elderly couple when I met them in the 80s, they said when they came up from Alabama to the coal fields, like they used to have to stand in line at the store until all the white people were served. And then when they got to the coal fields, that was no longer the case. The trains were not segregated. They could vote, which was for the first time ever. And so it was actually, despite the danger of coal mining, it was very appealing. If you were a sharecropper in Jim Crow South, it was very appealing to come to the coal fields and have more freedom that way. So there were a large segment of African Americans who came. Also, I'm half Italian. My Italian ancestors came at that time. There's a large Italian community in the coal fields, and a number of other ethnic groups: Poles, Czechs, Spaniards, just from everywhere that people came to work in the coal fields. And so it was a real melting pot. Even as late as when I was growing up, it was still that way.
Denise, I'd like you to talk about who are some of the key people we should know about from the mine wars.
Well, I fictionalized just about everybody, you aren't going to find many of the key people mentioned. For example, Mother Jones is not in my book at all. And there are reasons I could explain why that is, but she's not there. And Frank Keeney, who was one of the leaders of the union, is briefly mentioned. But when I was writing the book, actually, we didn't know, or a lot of people didn't know who some of the leaders were, for the reasons I've already mentioned, that it was dangerous. We know now that Bill Blizzard was probably the leader of the miners at Blair Mountain, but that was really not known when I was doing my research in 1980. And so that kind of forced me to fictionalize, actually, because I just didn't know for sure who the leaders were. But Bill Blizzard is a name. You know, we had a panel discussion at Shepherd recently, and he was talked about quite a bit. Frank Keeney, his great grandson Chuck Keeney, was on the panel this weekend. He was definitely one of the leaders. And of course, the leader of the union was John L. Lewis, but he was not necessarily happy about the mine wars and what was going on at Blair Mountain at all. So I don't know if I would include him or not as a leader, but definitely Frank Keeney and Bill Blizzard were two of the key people.
So Denise, what led up to the Battle of Blair Mountain, and what is so significant about this part of West Virginia history?
Well, a lot of events led up to the Battle of Blair Mountain. The push to unionize started around the turn of the century, maybe even earlier in the New River area. But there was a huge strike in 1912, 1913 on paint and cabin creeks in Kanawha County. And that was one of the biggest strikes in the nation of any kind. It lasted for a year. It was very dramatic. It got a lot of national attention. And you really could see the mine guard system, which was used to oppress the miners, was in full force. You had incidents like a coal operator put a machine gun on a train and they rode it up Cabin Creek and shot, or excuse me, Paint Creek, and shot up the tent colony there and killed a man. If you can imagine being a parent, a father or mother with children living in the middle of winter in a tent for over a year, that's the kind of conditions. So when we talk about what led up to Blair Mountain, it was putting up with that kind of living condition, and also having you couldn't walk down the street. If two people stopped and started talking, the mine guard would come up and say, "Break it up." The coal company would monitor your mail. So what we think of as First Amendment rights, one reason we have an American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, is because it was founded in response to the Paint Creek and Cabin Creek strikes, because people's civil liberties were being violated right and left. And so that kind of treatment, plus on top of that, the poor pay, the having to shop in the company store at company store prices, the fact that you were paid by the amount of coal that you dug, and when the company weighed the amount of coal you dug, they shorted you, so you didn't get credit for all the coal you had dug. And on top of that, the working conditions, the safety conditions, which were atrocious. So all those things, there was a halt briefly after that big strike, which ended in 1913. There was a halt because of World War One. And when World War One was over, of course, a number of miners served in the army, and then they came back to the conditions, and they were basically saying, why are we putting up with this? We just served our country in a major war. Why are we putting up with this? And so you really saw after the war in 1918, 1919, is when things started heating up again. And there were a number of events that led to Blair Mountain, including the murder of some of the leaders of the miners. And so things just escalated to that point where people just said, we can't take this anymore.
It's time for me to reintroduce my guest. Joining me to commemorate the centennial anniversary of the West Virginia Mine Wars and Trials is Denise Jardina. Denise is a two-time recipient for the Weatherford Award for significant Appalachian work for her novels Storming Heaven and Unquiet Earth. She was also the 2002 Appalachian Heritage Writer-in-Residence here at Shepherd University. You mentioned that John Lewis, who was the leader of the union at the time, was not a supporter of the Mine Wars. So what was the opinion of the union at large in response to the battle that happened at Blair Mountain?
I think the union was very supportive after it happened. They were very supportive of the people who were charged with treason, for example. But it also broke the bank. So it really bankrupted the union. So on the one hand, they were supportive and they did what they could. On the other hand, that's one reason they had kind of not been supportive beforehand, because they were afraid that that would happen. They were afraid it would get so intense and that the response would be so repressive that they would no longer be able to function. And that's basically what happened. They, for much of the 1920s, the union was pretty bankrupt and really didn't get going again until the 1930s.
So following the Battle of Blair Mountain, it ended with the arrest of 24 different coal miners who ended up being tried for treason. What happened during these trials, and why was it these specific 24 coal miners?
I'm not the person to answer that question. I noted when I was talking on the panel that I researched my novel from the 1890s up to 1921 with the Battle of Blair Mountain. And after the Battle of Blair Mountain, basically my main character dies. And so I stopped researching at that point. So I'm not the person to ask that question. I don't know why they picked the people that they did. I can guess a couple of them. One was Frank Keeney, who would be an obvious choice, and Bill Blizzard would be an obvious choice. There was a minister, a Pentecostal minister, who was very outspoken, who I'm guessing might have been chosen because he represented a minister in a church, the church, and it was like making an example of him. But I really don't know, and I don't know the others, why those people in particular were chosen. I just don't know.
Well, Denise, how did the media and the political establishment treat these miners while the strikes were ongoing?
The media, it depended on who the media was. Kind of like today, I guess. If you were on Fox News, you got treated one way. And if you were on MSNBC, you got treated another way, I guess. There were some progressive publications and newspapers that were very sympathetic. There was a guy named Winthrop Lane, who was a reporter for one of the New York papers. I forget the name of it. It's no longer in existence. I think the New York something. I can't remember. He was very sympathetic and actually wrote it. He took his articles and turned them into a book that was published. Others would not be so sympathetic. And it just depended on the media outlet. But there were a number of reporters. James Cain, who was a novelist who wrote mysteries, but he also came down and wrote a book about the mine wars and the treatment of the miners. He was very sympathetic. It just depended on who you looked at. Then there were others that were propagandists for the coal companies. So it just varied.
Perhaps you can talk about how these events, how did they shape how unions are today?
Well, the unions have gone through a lot of changes. There's no straight line. The unions were, as I mentioned, the UMW was pretty much bankrupted in the 1920s. But by the time of Roosevelt, when Franklin Roosevelt came along, he basically opened the door for union organizing, not just in the coal industry, but everywhere. And so the unions began to thrive. For reasons that are obvious, because people really needed them. The 30s and 40s especially were really high points for the union, especially the UMWA. In the 1950s, you saw coal being automated and many miners lost their jobs. And so there was a lot of pressure, and companies saw that as an opening to start breaking the union or to at least bend it. And what they did basically was kind of corrupt the union. So the union leadership in the 50s and 60s was very corrupt. They were basically, a miner would say, they're in bed with the coal operators. And so you had Tony Boyle, who was the leader of the union at that time, who actually had he had a reform candidate running against him for president of the union, and he had him murdered. And his wife and daughter, Jock Yablonski. And that was the nadir of the union. I think that was in the late 60s. But then you had a reform movement in the 70s that took over and put in reform candidates. And you had a very progressive union at that point. So throughout the 70s and 80s. But then in the 80s, this is like a roller coaster. In the 80s, you had Don Blankenship come along, who was the president of Massey Coal Company, who proceeded to bust one union after the other. And you had an administration in Washington, the Reagan administration, which was very anti-labor and were also supportive of busting unions. And so the union went downhill again. And it's just kind of been up and down like that. I think the union would be in pretty good shape now. I think the leadership is good, but they've lost so many members because of coal, of the downturn of coal. I saw a headline a day or two ago that said there are as many coal miners in West Virginia today as there were in 1892 when it first started. So the lowest number of miners since 1892 in 2022. So the union really doesn't have many members now.
Are people more favorable towards joining unions today?
I think the average person, yes, in West Virginia, I think there's still a lot of sympathy for unions, but there just aren't as many miners to join unions, and I think that's going to be the case from now on. I mean, I don't see, I may be wrong, and I think that and the war that Russia is waging on Ukraine might change this because of the energy situation. We might start needing coal again for a little while, but basically I think given climate change and the awareness of the national and global awareness of climate change, I don't think you're going to see coal coming back in any meaningful way. So I think the question would be more transitioning to other jobs and seeing how, I think nationally you're starting to see unions make a comeback in other areas like Amazon and Starbucks even. And I think people are going to see some of the benefits of unions, but not in coal.
Well, Denise, as we come to the end of our time together, I'd like to know, what do you see as being West Virginia's biggest issue right now?
Oh, goodness, the biggest issue. it's hard to separate West Virginia in some ways from the rest of the country. I think we've got a divide in this country that's really difficult to overcome. And I think it's a rural-urban divide. The only thing I would say about us being distinctive in that is that we have more rural than we do urban. We're probably the most rural state in the country. You look at places where progressive things are happening, it's in the cities. And the countries, the rural areas are being left behind. And it's partly not their fault, because then things like internet, broadband, that are really necessary for communication in this day and age, are harder to get in rural areas. And it's harder for people to get expanded opinions and news and so forth because of that. But if you look at, as a progressive person myself, I would feel more comfortable living in, say, Birmingham, Alabama, than I would in upstate New York, because the cities are progressive. And in West Virginia, that's true. Charleston, Huntington, Morgantown, Wheeling are all progressive places, but they're small compared to the overall rest of the state. And it's just harder to, you have people in the legislature who are trying to even stop the progressive things that are happening in cities, like cities are protecting LGBT rights, and the legislature is saying, no, you're not, you can't, we don't want you to do that. And that's really, that holds back the state economically as well. And it's one reason people are leaving the state. And I think that's, you know, if you're asking what the biggest issue in West Virginia is, I think that's it. We need to somehow break out of that and appeal to a broader range of people again, which we once did. We once did that, and we don't do it anymore.
Denise, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you for having me.
Denise Giardina is one of the many involved in commemorating the Mayan Wars and Trials in Charlestown, West Virginia, from between 1921 and 1924. Doug Estep, who runs Coal Country Tours, has planned a series of programs around this historic event, which shook the nation as well as the region and involved the Eastern Panhandle, with events continuing throughout the month of May. To learn more about these upcoming events, visit shepherd.edu/appalachian or visit us on our Facebook page, Appalachian Studies Program at Shepherd. Thank you all so much for listening, and until next time, I'm Bianca Eisen.
Voices from Appalachia Radio Show is sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. With the following created to enhance and develop the cultural and economic life of West Virginia and the Appalachian region. Academic programs that include an Appalachian Studies minor, an interdisciplinary BA, BS undergraduate degree, and a graduate certificate and master's degree in Appalachian Studies at Shepherd University. Celtic Roots and Global Appalachia Study Abroad and Celtic Heritage Series. The Appalachian Heritage Writers in Residence and Writers Award, which support the West Virginia Center for the Books, One Book, One West Virginia Common Read Selection. The West Virginia Fiction Competition. The Anthology of Appalachian Writers, an annual anthology featuring writing by the Heritage Writer, and poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, essays, and photography created by Appalachian writers across the region and the world. Voices from the Misty Mountains, NEH, and West Virginia Humanities Council Teacher Institutes, Shepherd Speaks StoryCorps Project, and this radio show, in cooperation with Shepherd University Public Radio Station, WSHC-FM. To learn more about our degree programs or upcoming events, visit us at our website at shepherd.edu/appalachian or at our Facebook page, Appalachian Studies Program at Shepherd.